Tuesday morning.
All right, good morning. The Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. What is today? It is not November 13th, it's November 15th. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for everyone that's come to listen to us today, for being patient with our late start. Rain, traffic, locked keys, all sorts of things delayed our arrival. So we will get started pretty quickly. We have an informational hearing, lots of items put together for us from DHS and the Oregon Health Authority and the Early Learning Division as well. I know that a lot of work has gone into these presentations, and I always think it's important to remember that on legislative days. Informational hearings, we get to listen and don't have to make decisions, but for each person that sits here and gives information to us, it really is hours and hours and hours of work from those individual people and all of the people that are standing up behind them to make that work possible. So thank you to everyone here that's come and all of the people back at the agencies that are watching to see the results of their good work over the last few weeks. So with that, I'm going to open up an informational meeting on the Department of Human Services leadership introduction an update, because we have a fantastic new child welfare director.
Good morning, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, Faribor Spaksuresh, Director of the Department of Human Services. My job is pretty easy and pleasant today. I have the pleasure of introducing our new Child Welfare Director, Marilyn Jones. Last time I came in front of you about a month ago, a couple months ago maybe, when was September anyway, I talked about our search far and wide to find the right person in this job. And ultimately, we ended up back in Oregon, in Baker City, and found the right person with the right background, a mix of business acumen and discipline combined with the passion serving children and families in Oregon. Marilyn has been on the job 5 weeks, 7 weeks?
This is 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
And time flies when you're having fun.
Yes. I can tell you that my job has been made a whole lot easier, and I think Lori Price also agrees with that. So with that, I will turn it over to Marilyn.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Gelser and committee members. My name, for the record, is Marilyn Jones, and I am the Child Welfare Director for the Department of Human Services. Before I get started and begin my testimony, I thought you might want to know a little bit about me and who I am, where I've come from. I retired out of the private sector, and I moved to a picturesque little town in eastern Oregon. And as we got settled, I realized that quaint little town was not what I expected. It was number one in abuse and neglect. It was number one in methamphetamine use in the state. I kept going home, back down to the San Diego area, and my husband asked how long would I be going home. I said, I don't know. So at that point, I decided I either had to invest in my new community, so I rolled up my sleeves and got to work. I went to the child welfare office, and I became, with my teenage daughter, a volunteer. I am the mom of five, the foster mom of 11, and the adoptive mom of two beautiful girls. I've worked for the state of Oregon for over 20 years. The last 10, I've been the district manager for Baker Union and Wallowa counties. I had the good fortune of meeting Faribor's, and when I left that meeting, I was optimistic, and I wanted to be part of his team, part of his vision, and I wanted to help change the culture of child welfare. I'm looking forward to working with all of you, and I believe that together we can create a program second to none. So let's get down to work, and we can start working together, being team members, and I just so appreciate you giving me the ability to come here today and to get to know you and to be able to share with you some of the information you're requesting today.
Thank you. Any questions? I just wanted to say I've had the chance to work with Marilyn over the last 6 weeks and saw her making some pretty significant decisions and changes within really the first 4 days, which I think we've all heard before the phrase hitting the ground running. This is a whole new level of sprinting, and it's a marathon. So thank you for being willing to do it. And just really thank you also for your presentation to the Human Services sub of Ways and Means yesterday, something that really impressed me. You were asked a question about kids in hotels, and it was a very precise number. And I was impressed that you knew a number. You knew exactly the number of kids that had been in a hotel last week and why. But you also were very open to say it's hard to know the numbers overall. And I think that is such a hard thing. We ask for a lot of information, but it's always okay to say you don't know or you don't have the data. And then we can learn where are the data points that we need to get and what's not useful. So I hope you'll always feel free to tell us when there aren't answers to the questions and when things are going wrong and you need help, because that's how we'll eventually be able to address the issues.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I think you're absolutely right, and I think one of the things that we talked about is that number changes. Yeah. And each night we do look at the report, and on Monday we had 11 kids that were in hotels and for various reasons. But what we're having them do now for us is to really break it down. Is it because we don't have placement? Is it because of behavior? So that we can really start dissecting our business and looking at how we can best serve these kids and get them out of the hotels and get them into places where they can start healing.
Thank you. And that demonstrates your business skill, and also knowing the numbers of kids gives that confidence that you're doing that work every day with all of these workers and supporting them, and knowing that each of these children is an individual person. So thank you for stepping up and agreeing to do this really, really hard job.
Thank you.
All right, shall we move into our next item? Anything else? All right, so let's move on to the DHS implementation update of the 2017 child welfare bills. And we allowed 40 minutes, but don't feel like you have to use an entire 40 minutes. It's Dr. Richardson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Gelser and committee members, Dr. Richardson and I will be going over where we are at the moment on these bills. It won't take us 30 minutes.
It we'll certainly won't take me 30 minutes.
We'll make up your time for you today. So the first bill is Senate Bill 942. This requires that all cases have a disposition of founded, unfounded, or unable to determine. It was our differential response and the ending of differential response. In August, the rules were repealed and staff were notified that there will no longer be a differential response throughout the state. But we decided that there were things that needed to still be looked at, and they formed a committee that can give us recommendations of what kind of practices that we found that were good in differential response and try to embed that in our Oregon safety model practice, such as just more engagement with our families, being able to, when possible, call ahead and let them know that we're coming, including self-sufficiency when we go out, or a domestic violence advocate, depending on what the need is for that family.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Do we have handouts on any of these or not? They're on?
Yes.
How do we find them?
If you go to OLIS and you go to our committee page for today. And
gotcha. I found him. I found him. Thank you.
Senate Bill 819 expands the parameters and duties and responsibilities of our CERT incident response team. In September, temporary rules were effective based on Senate Bill 819. In 2018, we will have a rulemaking hearing in January. I believe it is January 18th. February, the rule is in effect. We are looking at our CRT process and looking at how we can be inclusive in that process as we move forward.
Um,
Senator Gelser and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Reginald Richardson. I'm the deputy director for DHS. As a reminder, for this committee, Senate Bill 243 expanded the definition of abuse and also expanded the range of individuals DHS must notify when a report of abuse is received involving a child in care. In order to implement Senate Bill 243 and the related legislation that passed during the 2017 session, I sponsored an internal work group with representation from all impacted areas, such as child welfare, developmental disabilities, investigations, licensing, et cetera, to ensure that we are coordinating our efforts and using consistent communications. A detailed matrix was developed of the requirements of Senate Bill 243, and staff have been working on the various aspects to ensure that DHS is in compliance by January 1, 2018. There are three areas that we are working on: rules and procedures, staff training, and provider training. Let me talk a little bit more about each of those. Our Child Protective Services, or CPS, rules for foster home certification are being amended to comply with the requirements of 243, and procedures are being written to provide additional guidance to staff. For example, guidance on how to determine if a report of abuse falls under the new definition of abuse will be provided to screeners and staff who conduct CPS assessments. Also, we're updating our rules and procedures to ensure that DHS staff engage in all required internal and external notifications and communications when a report of abuse is received for a child in care. In regards to staff training, we're creating a training for DHS staff to help them understand the new types of abuse that apply to substitute care settings. More in-depth training will be provided for screeners, CPS workers, certifiers, caseworkers, supervisors, and consultants so that they are prepared to comply with the bill or the law and are able to respond to questions they may receive from providers. In regards to provider training, providers will be able to access several materials online, including the basic mandatory report training video and pamphlet, and a computer-based training on new definitions of abuse. Work continues on implementing 243, including completing training materials and outreach for foster parents, specifically the DD system. In regards to the DD system, we're working on coordinating with the local DD offices to communicate with DD-certified foster parents and share the update of the mandatory reporting video and computer-based training on the new requirements. My expectation is that we will be ready to comply with all the provisions and requirements of 243 by January 1st, 2018.
Go ahead. Any questions on that one?
Chair Gelser and the committee, my name is Marilyn Jones. I'm talking to you about House Bill 2216, which has established a sibling bill of rights. I was very fortunate to have a young man from my district that was very instrumental in the foster care bill of rights and this bill of rights as well. This is a youth-driven process, and I really love the fact that their voices are the ones that are heard. We have regular meaningful visitations, and they want to have regular meaningful presentations or visitations in place when they can't be housed in the same foster home. And that's something that we really want to work on so that we can continue to keep that bond with our children during visitations with each other. And that sibling bond is pretty incredible. I know we had an example where we had four children and a fifth that came along, and there was no room at the inn for the fifth. And so we made a concerted effort to make sure that that child was with their siblings every week, sometimes weekends, so that we had a connection. This bill, in what we've been doing with our committee, it has been run by Kevin George, working with our kids. The committee is having a timeline as follows. They had their first focus group in June, and then they followed through with many other focus groups through the month of August. In September, the first work group meeting was to develop the Oregon administrative rule. October, they had a second and third meeting with the youth, and our policy council appeared. They had posters, they submitted materials, rules advisories, policy council approval posters, and the Oregon administrative rules were filed with the Secretary of State. That was in November. In December, we'll have a public hearing of rules, staff notification, and staff notification in January. The rule will be in effect on 1/1/2018.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Marilyn, so the process is on track to have the posters and tip sheets ready this month?
Yes, they are.
I wonder if we could get copies of them.
Absolutely.
I'd really like to help distribute them, you know, for people in my district, and I'd like to see them.
Chair Gelser and committee, I will make sure that is taken care of.
Thank you.
We have Senate Bill 830, a current caretaker bill, and I would love to be able to address that in the questions that we're talking
sure.
about with adoption, if that would be okay.
That sounds great. Is that okay with everybody else? Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? No? That was the fastest 40 minutes ever. You can shorten our legislative session from 6 months to 3.
Okay. Deal.
All right. So I'm going to close that informational hearing and open an informational hearing on the DHS Unified Child and Youth Safety Implementation Plan. Welcome.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser and committee members. this presentation is with Nathan Ricks and myself, Marilyn Jones, as the Child Welfare Director. The Unified Plan was a plan that Nathan has been working on in his project team very diligently, together with Fair Boards in his role as the DHS Director and my role as the Child Welfare Director. We are fully committed in fully supporting the Unified Plan project, and we are ensuring that our Child Welfare Program Managers, our field staff, and our partners, our communities are working closely in partnership with the project team to ensure the success. I've been very fortunate to be updated on all 10. Nathan is going to highlight 3 of them. It has been my pleasure to be able to work with this team and watch them pull in the information that they need so that we can have a successful implementation of each and every one of these projects. So I'll turn it over to Nathan.
Good morning, members of the Commission, Chair Gelser. My name is Nathan Ricks. I'm the Director of Executive Projects in the Office of the Director with DHS. And my role and my charge is to develop and implement the Unified Child and Youth Safety Implementation Plan with a team of change agents that are partnered closely, like Marilyn said, with the Child Welfare Division. And I just wanted to start off by thanking Lori Price for her stability and partnership before Marilyn came on board, and really appreciate Marilyn's continued partnership as we make these improvements together. So as you may recall, the Unified Child and Youth Safety Plan responds to a challenging period of tragedies related to child safety and substitute care. And the governor and our former director, Clyde Psyche, commissioned an independent review of the DHS substitute care system, particularly focusing on child safety. And that report determined several steps needed to improve the system. What the Unified Plan does is it builds on those recommendations and findings and sets out the use of project management to bring about that change in partnership with program management across the agency. The independent review highlighted critical gaps in the safety system that range from child welfare to our backgrounds check unit, licensing, human resources, and OWAPI, which is the Office of Adult Abuse and Prevention Investigations. And our response, our plan, describes the actions that we'll take in response to the independent review. It is a portfolio of 10 projects, like Marilyn mentioned. We originally started with approximately 80 and funneled them down through the use of a steering team. And it was important to us in setting up our change strategy to really empower community members that had been a part of that external review and that had policy proposals and changes that they saw that needed to be made in their community. So we said, we want to create a space for you to give us direction on how these projects could proceed, and that's the origin of our 10 projects. Our goals for the child safety plan, first and foremost, is child safety. And the plan focuses on our efforts to reshape the way we do business at DHS. And we know that in order to ensure child safety, the first piece of that is establishing trust with our local communities, between DHS departments, with families, with providers, and youth receiving services. Our second component of that is to ensure children and youth needs are considered when delivering services, especially substitute placement decisions. And when allegations of abuse come in, we need to ensure that we have a safe and swift and comprehensive response to reports of child abuse. We want to, across the whole department, not just child welfare, cultivate a youth-centered and family-first culture within DHS. And we know that to do that, that means we need to empower and train our staff effectively, and we need to empower and train our providers that partner with us, like our foster families and licensed child caring providers. So what I'd like to do moving forward, as Marilyn mentioned, is to highlight three of the 10 projects. In the written testimony that we submitted, you should see two PDF packets. One is a set of one-pagers for each one of the 10 projects, and this is what we're using to summarize the scope of each one of these 10. And then we have more detailed status reports, and those are also on our website, OregonChildSafetyPlan.org. And with our commitment to transparency and using project management, we'll continue to put those on our site. But we've put them up on OLIS for convenience for you all. So the first project that we'd like to give you a status report on is the hotline centralization and standardized training for caseworkers who do screening. So why are we doing this project? In addition to the fact that this was a prime finding of the public knowledge report, the hotline project is needed to improve consistency in the way child abuse calls are managed across the state. Centralizing the hotline will improve child safety outcomes and ensure timely, safe, and comprehensive responses to reports of child abuse. When the project's completed, our vision of what the hotline will look like is a statewide, high-quality screening process that provides consistent, safe responses and reliable customer service to those that call in the hotline from our community. Our heavy users in the community we know are medical professionals, school staff, especially school nurses, and also law enforcement. And we know that sometimes their only interaction with the child safety system is through that hotline, and that we need to have a reliable, consistent operation. The other component of this is that we want to be able to staff this 24/7 and 7 days a week. Right now it looks different depending on what district you're in. So how will we go about doing this? First, the project began with establishing a governance structure. We broke up the work that needed to be done into subgroups, again made up of community members, of staff from all levels of our organization. And the tasks that they're working on now are identifying a suitable facility to house the hotline operation and creating a consistent ongoing training for screening staff. which begins with core competencies. As a former middle school teacher, core competencies and proper training, I think, are really the beginning of how you set that standard for everyone that's doing one job. Then the team is working on a transition plan to implement the project over the course of the next year, and implementing a communication and engagement plan so that we can describe what the impact of this transition is going to be to our local communities and to staff that are already doing this job or similar ones in the field. So going a little deeper into where we are now with this particular project, we are in the project design phase. And again, with Lori and Marilyn's leadership, we have maintained a commitment, leadership commitment to prioritizing this project and making sure that we have all levels of the organization engaged in making the transition. We have established a partnership with the Casey Family Programs and Action for Children Protection, which is the group that helped us develop our safety model, in order to create a training curriculum that works with how we're already doing business. So we want to make sure that from the get-go we're aligned in how we're applying our safety model. And a point of just a benefit that we've had in this partnership is that training development, it comes at no cost to the state through Casey's partnership with Action. However, as we begin to implement that training, that will have an impact on our current staff. And when the February session comes around, we should be able to tell you exactly how we'll be training our staff to implement this. As I mentioned, we're finalizing the location of the hotline and have narrowed options per the governor's executive order 17-02 to use existing leased and owned buildings, and we'd like to share the details with that as with you too in the February session. So communication is vital for successful implementation of this project. There have been other states that have been down this path, and we have compiled lessons learned and memorialized those in a business case that describes how we're going to move forward. But we want to make sure that we move cautiously forward and that we resource the hotline effectively. Our neighbors to the north in Washington did begin to centralize their hotline, and it wasn't implemented very successfully, so they actually pulled back to a regional model. So we're going into this with eyes wide open and at the same time moving as quickly as we can to meet our project plan.
So that means, just a question.
Of course.
Yes. So if it wasn't successful to have a centralized system, what are the reasons do you feel Oregon is different than Washington, who had to then go regionally?
Chair Gelser, members of the commission, Senator Mona Anderson, the benefits that we've seen in other states that have successfully implemented the hotline are really that we have a common supervision over everyone doing that task, that if a screener gets a especially complex call that comes in, that they can go directly to a specialized unit or to their supervisor to resolve that. We know that we can increase response times that way. And again, you know, the real pain point for the state of Washington was their resourcing. And I'd add that I think collectively we're very thankful that we were able to get from you all last session. We earned through our staffing formula additional screeners to contribute to this project. Are there any other questions that we have on the hotline project before we move on to second?
Okay. I have a question, but I'll leave it for the end.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. So moving on to our second project that I'd like to highlight. This is our project that looks at the continuum of care across state government. We want to be able, our vision is to be able to meet the needs of children regardless of what state agency they're in. And we know that many of the most vulnerable youth that we serve are involved with multiple systems. So we call them multiple system kids, or they're involved with cross systems. And we know that some of these systems we intersect with are the juvenile justice system, the health authority, and children's mental health needs, also within DHS developmental disabilities. And within that guardian role that we have as a child placing agency, child welfare is really the one that's ultimately accountable for meeting the health and safety needs. Yet that continuum, right, that continuum of services across state government is overseen and funded by multiple agencies. So what this project does is it takes the lead on setting up a seamless system of care to ensure that youth and child needs are met. And I want to acknowledge really at the outset that the environment that we've been operating in has been one of crisis. And what we need in order to solve and strike at the root of this need for a continuum is to step back from crisis-driven solutions, as critical as those are, and form a system that makes sure that no kids can fall through the cracks. So this project is an answer to thinking beyond where we are with our placement crises. So how are we going to do this? Well, we're going to begin with our convening authority, and Director Pak Suresh and Marilyn Jones, as well as other executives in the agency, have asked for us to convene leaders within the Oregon Health Authority, the Youth Authority, Child Welfare, the Intellectual Disabilities Program, Department of Education, and other experts such as folks at OHSU, people that are experts in the system of care. And the goal of this group is to create those shared solutions so that we have a seamless continuum. And just to be clear, our outcomes are that we have a structure for placement and services that are available to children and youth based on what those needs of the youth are, that we have a structure to support local communities in removing barriers to care for children and youth. We want to make sure that on the back end and on the state agency side that our policies and procedures are aligned, that we increase child safety as a principal throughout all of this, and that in making placement decisions, a child is in that optimally safe environment that's also the least restrictive environment for youth. We are in the active planning stage. We have a charge, like you mentioned, from Director Pak Suresh, and we'll be working with the Oregon Health Authority to ensure we have a cross-agency partnership. We have a white paper that's submitted that does outline some of our initial recommendations, and we're in a process of socializing that with other agencies and other systems as we take the lead on convening folks to have this conversation. So I think our biggest risk in moving forward with this is that it is really the root of the capacity crisis. We have a genuine need really at every level for additional community providers, for foster parents to meet those capacity needs. But the goal of this group really is, again, to step back from that capacity crisis and to create that space for creating a system that works for all kids.
Yes.
Do we have any numbers of how many reports of child abuse come into the state, say an average per day?
Senator, members of the commission, Chair Gelser, Senator Mona Sanderson, that's a number I'd be happy to look up and provide to you.
I was just wondering, is it 10? Is it 20? One? Okay. I was just wondering how big this centralized system, how many calls they will be taking statewide.
Yeah. Chair Gelser, members of the commission, Senator Amona Sanderson, I'd be happy to speak to a precise number with you.
I don't need to know. I was just curious as how overwhelming this would possibly be. Thank you.
Other questions?
Senator Denberg.
Thanks, Chair. You know, both of those projects seem really very well thought out in terms of the project design and what you're hoping for in terms of, you know, the final product. I'm just wondering, you know, both of those projects are designed to solve particular problems that we've experienced. And I wonder if you could kind of clarify what kinds of changes you see coming out of this, right? I mean, where, you know, in the recent past, we've had certain problems that both the centralized phone line and the new, more integrated program design should avoid in the future. And then how you will ascertain that it's working, right? I mean, it's one thing to see that, you know, to have as an outcome the right design, but we also want to see that the right design is actually working in the real world, right? So could you say something about that?
Chair Gelser, members of the commission, Senator Dembrow, this is really the focus of the work we're doing around performance metrics for our projects. And I'll use the centralized hotline as an example. You know, the outcome is both a centralized hotline, a physical, you know, location, but the ultimate goal is that we are so successful in providing all of the services across state government that we see communities thriving and a lower number of calls coming into the system. And we can measure that. We can measure how many calls are coming into the hotline from day one of a centralized hotline, how many are substantiated, and what that number looks over time. So our ultimate goal is fewer calls coming into the system. But the other inputs to that are we have to rethink the way we provide services in communities. I will say as well with the hotline project, from what we've learned from other states, is that when they've successfully implemented a hotline operation, that because of the publicity and because of the awareness, that the greater awareness that the public has, that number typically goes up. And that could be for several reasons. One could be that there is abuse going on in a community that isn't being reported now, and so we're better capturing the number of allegations, alleged abuse. And or it could be, you know, that it's simply awareness and it's folks responding to the fact that the number is in front of them, and that opens their eyes to other things happening in the community. So so I just want to emphasize that we can measure that, and, you know, our ultimate goal is reducing the number of allegations of abuse.
Right. So just to follow up, so you want to initially probably increase the number of calls, right? You want fewer people kind of falling through the cracks and having an easy way to call in and report. But then at some point, and I suspect that's probably pretty far down the line, everything will have worked so well and you feel confidence in that this will really be a sort of infrequent last resort kind of thing, because it's the need is not going to be there. That might be hard to measure exactly.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Senator Dunbrow, I think one of the things that you're asking too is we have gone from 36 counties doing screening to 15 counties, I believe, at this time doing screenings. A lot of that has to do with education for our communities. They want to talk to somebody they know. They want to be able to call one number. They don't want to think about it being outside of their community, because they don't believe anybody cares about their community. So part of that is going to be education. But what we have is 15 screening units that screen differently, and they're managed differently. And I think that the most important thing for me is that within this new centralized hotline, they not only said that the calls would go up, the number of calls would go up, because we have educated all of our communities. They know how to call. You have well-trained staff. That they also said the call length has changed in some instances from 5 minutes to an average of 25 minutes for each call. So a lot of it, too, is the in-depth information that they're getting, which will really help us make sure that our kids are safe.
Chair Gelson, members of the commission, I'd like to move on to the third project to highlight. And the context for this is we have recently implemented a new core training for our caseworkers. The first cohort is going through our training right now. And the next step of this is to look at our supervisor training, supports we provide to those that that give mentorship and they give direction to the folks that are doing most of our work on the ground. The project around supervisor training responds to the problem that supervisors in child welfare self-report that they're not adequately prepared for their diverse role within the agency. And we're going to take a three-phase approach to the implementation of supervisor training. We've already begun to execute phase one, which began in September 2017. The supervisor quarterly meetings have been redesigned to include professional development and training opportunities, and as well as creating a space to have peer mentoring opportunities and communities of practice. The second phase of this is to develop and implement a supervisor conference in March of 2018. So a work group has already been formed, and we're actively planning the conference. The idea now is to have those conferences in Bend and Hood River to create flexibility for supervisors to be able to have coverage back in their home district, but then to be able to come to these conferences to get really nationwide leaders in clinical supervision to come and learn there. And then the third phase, which is really where we started with our unified plan project, is redesigning those fundamental things that a course supervisor learns when they enter into that position. We know now that many supervisors are promoted because they're good caseworkers, and we want to make sure that we enhance that skill set by providing them with those management capabilities and the ability to provide mentorship and problem solving to a group of caseworkers rather than just on single cases. The current supervisor training is part of our contract agreement with Portland State University. And in November and December of this year, the work group is completing a needs and gap assessment to really take a hard look at the current training and figure out where we have gaps, as well as what pieces we may want to redesign. And then that will launch the work of that redesign for next year.
Yes. How will you know that it's successful? I mean, this is very important, without a doubt. And what will you be looking at to know that this is actually making managers better able to provide the oversight that's needed? Will it be querying the line workers? Will it? I mean, how are you going to assess success?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, and Senator Dembro, I think that there's going to be a lot of different measurements that we'll be taking. One of the core responsibilities for me is to hold people accountable. We will be changing the way the work looks across the state, where supervisors will be having weekly confers with each of their caseworkers so that we can really see and they have an intimate knowledge of the cases so that we know where each case is and what each child is doing and that they're receiving the best services possible. So we'll be able to start looking at their capacity building, their leadership capacity building, because truly they have to be leaders to be able to to run a business like this. We want to be proactive versus reactive. So those are all things that we will be looking at as we shift. I can tell you already, I'm seeing a shift in the field just from some of the supports that we're receiving, such as the 50 STARS positions or the consultants, educators, and trainers that are now going to be out in the field. What it's done is give the field hope that they have the supports that they need and that they can really concentrate back on the work. But we'll also be working with our research and analytics department. We have Dr. Paul Bellotti that's working with us to really dig in and get data, baseline data now. In fact, he's looking at baseline data at this moment, for us as we start, so that we can really see how those improvements are working in many different categories.
And, Chair Gelser, members of the Commission, Senator Dembrow, the one, I think, benefit of having done the caseworker redesign training is that we can learn from what's been successful there. And three things that are included in that are different from how we used to do the core training. The first is self-assessments that are provided by workers and supervisors. The second would be that we look at knowledge-based exams. We have both of those included in the core competency training. And the third are scenario-based learning evaluations. So in the core training right now, a caseworker has an opportunity to practice knocking on the door of a family or community to have a difficult conversation, and that's video recorded, and then it's sent in sort of a online package to their current supervisor. Mm-hmm. And so we want to look at those three to see the success of those three with the caseworker training and see how we can translate those over to the supervisor core.
That's great. And is there a component of line staff evaluation of their supervisors? Is that a regular thing that happens? I think that can be very useful as well. So, I mean, the caseworkers evaluating their managers.
So thank you. For the record, again, Fair Borse, PACSRH Director of Department of Human Services, Chair Gelser, Senator Dembrow, you're asking all the right questions. So, and I think my answer is going to be broader than child welfare, but what we are going to be focusing on across DHS, and particularly in child welfare, is specifically what does outcome looks like. So within 2 weeks, we're going to be starting the mapping process within child welfare with focus on a few key questions, such as what is the work? How does that work get done? Who's responsible and accountable for it? And then what does the outcome look like if we actually do that work well? And we will do this in the various pieces of the work that we do. For example, assessment is a core process. So if you're actually doing the assessment, how does that work get done across the organization? What is the work? And then if you're actually doing assessment well, what are the outcomes of that? This is what we'll be working on within the next few months. Those of you who have seen the fundamentals map for Oregon Youth Authority, you know what I'm talking about. That's what we're going to be focusing on, specifically as to what caseworkers have to say about their managers. There is a random annual employee survey that goes out that asks specific questions about leadership and management, and that's partly how we collect that feedback. But, you know, as part of this process of mapping, it is also going to bring about to surface all of the flaws that exist within the organization, and we actually celebrate finding those, because if we don't know what's wrong, we can't do anything about fixing them. So part of this also relates back to changing the culture within the organization. Specifically, child welfare has been under stress within the past 18 months or so, or perhaps even longer, and when organizations are under stress, people are fearful of making decisions because they're afraid of making the wrong decisions. And as we begin looking at our work and answering those questions that I shared with you, we are hoping to also address the issue of culture by creating a safe environment where people feel safe, bring those flaws up, and then hopefully involve them in solving them, because ultimately the people who do the work know most about the work and can help us get there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions before we move on to the next? All right. Thank you. So we'll close the informational hearing on the Unified Safety Plan and Centralized Child Welfare Screening Update. Yeah, kind of both done. And open up informational hearing on general adoption efforts. Start with DHS and then move on to Sherry. Does that work for everybody? Great. And I think these are also in OLIS documents. Yeah.
It's just that it's all says task E, task F, task G, and I'm not sure where we are on OLIS with.
It does say also Unified Child Safety. We'll make it
more specific. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, there is nothing in OLIS regarding this presentation on adoption. The items that you're talking about, Senator, are all the 10 priority projects of the...
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
Of course. Senator, Chair Gelser, committee members, for the record, my name is Marilyn Jones. I am the Director for Child Welfare. And first and foremost, I would like to thank Senator Gelser for asking the questions. For asking the right questions, for asking the hard questions, because that's how we're going to dig into seeing where our system is and what we need to do to improve. I'll welcome the opportunity to address questions that I received from Chair Gelser specifically to our adoption practice. I want to say on the onset that I'm absolutely committed to transparency and partnership. I think management by and communication of data is key to creating a child welfare system that is second to none. I am also, however, committed to ensuring that the data I share on behalf of the Department of Human Services is accurate and reliable. I'm pulling together information pursuant to the chair's questions, and I found that some of our data does not meet those standards. This is clearly not satisfactory. However, we're very fortunate that we have Dr. Paul Bellotti, the new Director of Research and Analytics, working with us now to help us make sure that the data is not only accurate, that we can dig in and dig deep to find out what the systematic issues might be in any question that we ask. They will be producing this accurate information, and they gave us some responses that I think you will be pleased with, but I think we also will need to have ongoing conversations about where we go with our adoption process. The first question that I would like to address, and what I can speak to in confidence, is our federal fiscal year of 2016. We could go back and look at that data and pull out some of the information that was requested. We finalized 748 adoptions last year. 82% of those adoptions were adopted by current caretakers and foster parents and or relatives. The remaining 17.6% were adopted by general application. We had 57.7% of our adoptions were with current caretakers and non-relatives, and 42% were relative adoptions. The first question that was asked is, what is the average age of children that are adopted with families that are non-relative or non-foster parent providers, general applications? That average age is 6.5. With regard to the question about timeliness to adoption, I was able to look back for federal fiscal year 2016 again. The shortest time of adoption was 11 months. We pull a median number. The median number is used so that outliers won't bias the data that we're using. The median was 36 months, which again is not acceptable. Our goal is 24. The maximum was an outlier of 135 months, or close to 10 years. I do know from my own experience that there is a story behind every adoption and every child. So when I look at that number, I really have to be able to dig in and see what were the issues that caused us to have to wait 135 months.
Marilyn, after the presentation, would it be, I see us all like scribbling the numbers down really fast, would it be possible to get them in writing?
Absolutely.
Later? Thank you.
Absolutely. You don't have to scribble anymore. there's clearly room for us to improve on each case and the individual cases that are extreme. I also want to tell you that as far as this calendar year, from January 1 until August 31st, we cannot pull adoptions until the judge signs the order, so we won't know until the order is signed and that is input into our system. But we've had 420 adoptions finalized as of August 31. That puts us on a track of about 560 adoptions for this year.
Do you have an idea of why that number would be down so much from 2016, that was 748?
I believe that we, our foster care certifiers and adoption workers, with our numbers and staffing, we're not well staffed. The ability to do general applications for adoption, I think, was compromised. But that's my opinion. I have not looked into that data to clarify that.
So just as a follow-up, it doesn't reflect a significant decrease in the number of children waiting for a permanent home?
No. Okay. No. You did ask how many children are legally free currently. We have 8,003 children in foster care as of 8/31/17.
That are legally free for adoption?
No.
Okay.
That's it, just children in foster care. We have a total of 1,119 children, 14%, that are legally free and awaiting homes.
And would you say that percentage again?
14% of the children in foster care are currently legally free.
And follow up. And what's the age span of those 1,000? That are waiting? Is it from very young to teenagers? Is there?
Chair Gelser, Senator Moniz Anderson, please just give me a second and I can look at these numbers and give you some age groups. 0 to 2. Not legally free is 23%. Legally free is 17.5%, and I can make sure that you all receive this document at the end. Age groups 3 to 5, 23.6%, or 264 of those children. Age group 6 to 8 is 15.8%, or 177 children. 9 to 11 is 16% at 181 children. 12 to 14 is 12.7%. 15 years or older is 159, or 14.2%.
Thank you.
So truly it's across the board from 0 to 18. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
The next question that was asked was, what does recruitment look like for an adoption? We conduct recruitment from the Oregon Adoption Resource Exchange. They do our bulletins for our kids, for people who have already been certified as adoptive parents. We also recruit locally, statewide, for both foster parents and adoptive parents. And we use Wendy's Child, Adopt Us Kids newsletters, Oregon Adoptive Resource Exchange, BGAD, which is the Boys and Girls Aid of Oregon, the Heart Gallery, the Oregon Family Outreach, A Family for Every Child, the Oregonian, the Seattle Times, and Embrace Oregon Facebook are all means that we use to recruit and retain foster parents and adoptive parents. Number five, the question was, for older children and youth, what voice do they have in their own adoption process? And I really do appreciate that question. I feel very strongly that it is a best practice and my expectation that always a child's voice is included in their life decisions as we move forward. It is critical that these decisions are made case by case, child by child, and that their cognitive ability is also a factor of whether or not they can help make those decisions. But we really truly need to be looking and listening to these kids and where they want to go. I know that I have a young teenage group of twins, boy and girl, who were taken into custody at age 16. The boy wanted to be adopted. His sister didn't. She wanted guardianship. So the family did guardianship for the girl and adopted the boy. But we allowed them to have that voice, and I think that that's incredibly important for us to do. Question number six is, when does DHS choose guardianship for a child? When DHS chooses guardianship for a child, what safeguards do we have in place for when the child is 18? This, too, is a tough question, because when a child goes into guardianship, the agency no longer has legal authority for the care, supervision, or custody, or offer services beyond providing guardianship assistance and medical coverage for that child. At 18, however, we 5 months before the child turns 18, we send out communication to that family to let them know that they have the option of moving forward, such as with requests for extensions of guardianship. We let them know that their guardianship will be ending, that medical will be ending, and that we give them their options of what they can do to help that child get OHP coverage. And we extend their medical coverage for an additional month while they are working with our agencies, other agencies, to get that medical coverage that they need.
Can I just ask a clarifying question to make sure I understand? So when my kids at home became adults under the Affordable Care Act, they can remain on my insurance right until they're 26 without any further action on their part or mine. And I know from having sent my daughter off to college, even getting her to organize getting her prescriptions picked up on time can be challenging because 19 and 20-year-olds have a lot in their mind.
Yeah.
For foster youth, if they move on to Oregon Health Plan and they've got that additional month, but they're not automatically on insurance, they then become responsible in a way that other 18 to 26-year-olds are not, for managing the reapplication, turning the paperwork, being stable enough for those re-enrollment notifications to come to them at home. Is that a gap that I'm imagining, or is that a real gap for these young people?
Chair Gelser, I haven't looked at the data to be able to give you a clear-cut answer of whether or not we have children falling through the gaps. What I can tell you is that a lot of our guardianships are relative placements. They have extended family. They have good supports that go on after they're 18. And I think that hopefully those families are really helping them be able to get everything that they need so that they can have that same experience that your daughter did going off to college.
I just wonder, moving forward, and this is for our healthcare committee chair, if there's a way, I don't know if it would be general fund or something else, just to make sure that these kids coming out of foster care have that same access and protection through age 26 that other people in the state have. I mean, I think that's beyond child welfare policy and more of a healthcare policy, but
I know that. I mean, this just brought a lot of questions to my mind, and first of all, I would like to know from Oregon Health Authority in the Medicaid program, how long does it really take for a person to get the application through to have it processed? I mean, I'm hearing stories that it's several months, so I think there's a lot more information that we need to get to see how difficult, say, someone in the foster care. Can we have a fast track for those who are in foster care or something? But anyway, lots of questions.
Thank you for letting me disrupt there for a minute. The fifth question was, for older children and youth, what voice do they have for their own adoption process? I think we kind of covered that a little bit. Mm. I think it's important that they have a voice. We just looked at a case with a child that was 16 years old, and the first voice I wanted to hear is whether or not they wanted to be adopted, and how did they see where their life was going, and where did they want it to go? And I think that's the most important voice to hear first, and then we can talk to the experts and the other people to find out whether or not they agree with those findings. I think it's a major consideration, not only in adoption, but in any life decision that they have when they are under our care. We need to make sure that they are helping us direct where they're headed. Seven, you asked the question about disparity of practice around CPS-involved moms who want to proactively make an open adoption for a plan at birth. And again, I appreciate the question, because every time someone asks me a question, I have to go find the answer. I really appreciate this question. It's always important to listen to moms and consider their plans for their children. When we go and visit with them, we hope that they will make a plan for their families, while always keeping the best interest of the child at the very forefront. I have reviewed policy and practice, and I can see that we have a need to improve our processes. Both Lacey Andreessen, my new adoption manager, I believe she's been here about 9 weeks, maybe 10, and I are committed to looking at our adoption practice as a whole and to make improvements in order to best serve the individual needs of every child and every family. Lacey and I would welcome the opportunity to meet with you, Chair Gelser, and any of the other committee members that would be interested to discuss future details and how that we can go about making those changes. I'm also looking forward to hearing the perspective from Sherry Levine, and would love to welcome her to participate in that committee as well.
Chair, I just remembered that Medicaid enrollment has switched to DHS. I always forget. So we need to hear from DHS. And I see nods back there regarding the issue of coverage for our foster care youth. Yeah.
Chair Gelser and Senator Monis Anderson?
Monis Anderson.
Mm-hmm. I can speak just from my perspective from being a district manager and having self-sufficiency and medical being handled by our staff. That we have our same day, next day policy that if a child comes in with an application, that application is retroactive of the day that it is stamped, and the process should be completed rather quickly. I don't know about the larger districts. I know that we are slowly turning medical back over to us. The same day, next day has been with our TANF and with our SNAP recipients, but that would be our hope that we would continue that practice.
And I really appreciated your comments, bouncing back to the adoption and that the focus on the child. When I was a young mom and going through the adoption process the first time, I was really struck in the training that the training talked about adoption is not about a process of finding children for families. It's about a process of finding safe and permanent homes for children. And that is just, I can still see that trainer standing there and saying that, and it would be fantastic if that's what we could all always focus on. It's such an emotional situation, especially when you have a lot of people that love a child and want to support them. It's not easy, but that child is the one, if we can remember, that it's always about. And I appreciate you saying that.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Question number 8. you asked about our adoption committee and how it works, and is there a general applicant, a difference between a general applicant and a current caretaker? Is that correct? Yes?
Sort of.
Okay. we're looking at whatever is, again, in the best interest of the child, whether it's a current caretaker or a relative. We have to look at where this child has been, what this child has done, what the bonding is for this child. We need to listen to the experts. But we have to make the decision, because we always have many loving families that are interested in adopting these children. They're all good families. It's about what is the best placement for that child. At this point in time, what with Bill 830,
it's a cheat sheet.
Is it 830?
Yes, good job.
At this point, current caretakers and relatives have the same standard or the same level of participation in adoption.
And so I have, and Lori and I talked about this previously. There was a situation in which, so I've now heard the story several times, so it could be any case. It's not a particular case, but the one that we talked about, the adoption committee met. They made a unanimous recommendation that the child stay with the family that had had that child since birth, and the child was like 3 years old. The adoption specialist overturned the decision and decided to move the child to people that the child had not lived with. And what that current caretaker was told was, the law just says you get to go to the committee. If it wasn't for the law, you wouldn't have even made it to the committee. So I just am wondering, once it's at the committee, and that's what the law speaks about, getting to the committee, how do we know when it's all wrapped in confidentiality that the spirit of that law is followed, and it's not just the technicality of being in the committee?
Chair Gelser and the committee members, I can, you're going to have to grow to trust me. I did look at that process myself. And no one will be making a decision in isolation. And any time a committee is overturned, there will be a staffing to understand why, and we will be fully informed before that decision moves forward. And that's a change, again, from having questions asked and being able to look at things, having the opportunity to look at our processes and making those changes.
Thank you.
I believe that was our last. Oh, no, we have number 9. please discuss how training is happening, what retraining is happening for adoptive specialists, how the new rule is being implemented that calls out for the need for expertise in a person has current expertise in the importance of stable attachment for children, and how we are ensuring that once a person has current caretaker status, they are considered completely equal blood relatives as required by law. I think that we have gone through that a little bit here this morning. We've done comprehensive training in the field around Senate Bill 741, and that is inclusive of our adoption workers and our committee members and our what we call our ADS specialists. They're our adoptions decision specialists. We are preparing a communication in the field regarding Senate Bill 830 at this time and the changes in that law, and that will go in effect on January 1.
Thank you. Any other questions about
it? I have a question. Just going back to the demographic data, Marilyn.
Mm-hmm.
To what level, you have it broken down by age, is it also broken down by disaggregated in other ways, male, female, race, ethnicity, that disability, that kind of thing?
It is not.
It would be helpful.
Is that hard to get? Good answer. Thank you.
Chair Gelser, committee, and Senator Dembro, that is an excellent question. We certainly have probably one of the best data people that I have worked with in my career. I'm excited to see if we, I know that we're looking at disparities as we speak. We believe our disparities will, our numbers will look probably worse before they look better, because we're actually going to get some real accurate, strong data that we can look at. And I think that that's something that we could probably see if that's, if we can pull that out in those numbers. And I certainly will ask and see if we can and get that additional information. And when I say get worse, it's not that there are more kids of disparity in our system. It is that we will have a realistic number of what those kids, who those kids are, and how we can best serve each of them.
So in those demographic numbers, I think the one that is most important to me is that 1,119 children in our system today that are waiting for adoption. And, you know, I appreciated that you were able to articulate the number of kids that slept in a hotel. And we know that we have 8,003 children that each have names and birth dates that are in foster care today. I went to a presentation several years ago, and I think it was a Casey family thing, and maybe it was Georgia, but this state had a dashboard, and every day, the governor knew, the director of child welfare knew, the director of DHS knew, the chairs of the Senate committees and the House committees knew exactly the number of kids in foster care, kids that were waiting, if there had been a fatality, just to keep at the top of everyone's minds that it wasn't just a number, it was kids. And I would like to be able to know that number on a daily or a weekly basis, and know that we're always mindful of what those numbers are. And I don't know if that's something Casey can help with, or if you remember what state I'm talking about, but.
Chair Gelser and committee members, we certainly will look into that, because I think that the most important thing for me is transparency. I receive those numbers every day on kids in hotels. I think that if there is a schematic, I would be certainly willing to talk to you and see what numbers are important, how often you would like to get those as a reminder, and we can see what we can put together.
And I think that the number of kids in hotels is important, and that's what we're reading a lot about in the paper right now. But all of these numbers fit together. If we know that we have, I mean, there's two ways to reduce the number of kids in foster care. The first is, or three ways. One, you make sure you're not putting kids in foster care that don't need to be there. You exit them as quickly as you can, as safely as you can. And when kids are free, you get them to permanency as soon as possible. And with 14% waiting for adoption, if we were able to get those kids matched, that would reduce those capacity issues for those number of kids that are in hotels as well. So they all the pieces fit together, which is hard when you have a lack of resources. So, you know, you send everybody out to get caught up on the assessments that were behind, which was really important and happened. That's going to reduce the number of visits that can be made for certification or home study. And that's where we come in, to give adequate resources to make sure that we're not making you stop all of your work in one area of practice to try to catch up on something that you've fallen behind on, only to start the cycle again. Once you're caught up there, we move all the resources out to have you do the next thing.
Senator Gelser, Chair Gelser, thank you very much. I appreciate that, and I will make sure that you are highly informed, and the committee is as well, because we do need you as our champions. We do need you to help us reduce barriers and to make sure that we are able to serve our families and children as best possible. Thank you. Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question? Just struck me. When foster parents adopt children, become the adoptive parents, do we tend to lose them then as foster parents? I mean, do they then need to be replaced, you know, to help with other children? Or do many of them continue to take foster children?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dembro, that's an excellent question. I would say in my world, and what I've experienced, is we lose probably 3/4 of them once the adoption is final. There's many reasons for that. Some, it's really difficult for the kids that have been adopted to have foster parent kids coming in and out. They sometimes worry about when are they going to leave. It it's not as stable for them. Sometimes it's just that the parents want to really focus on the needs and the special needs of the kids that are placed in their home and now their children. So there's many reasons, but we do lose them as soon as, and that's probably a really good data point for me to get as well. How many do we lose once adoption is final?
So next, we are really lucky to have Sherry Levine here from Open Adoption and Family Services. And I think, are you starting with the video?
No, I'm just going to end with the video.
End with the video. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Then we can all use our Kleenex. So hi, I'm Sherry Levine. I'm the director of Open Adoption and Family Services. I've been with the agency for 25 years. Thank you so much for having me here today. I'm also an adoptive mom. And raised in open adoptions. We have very close relationships with both of their birth parents. So I'd like to tell you just a little bit about our agency and about our initiative. We are a nonprofit agency licensed in Oregon and Washington with offices in Eugene, Portland, and Seattle. Over the past 32 years, we've placed over 1,450 children in open adoption families and become the experts on open adoption in the Northwest, and now we're national spokespeople. As we've been talking about, there's a foster care crisis in Oregon and across the country. We feel that DHS staff work so hard to protect kids from abuse and neglect, but the system is overburdened. So we would like to reach out and offer our assistance by kind of expanding our partnership with DHS. Nationally, one-third of all children waiting in foster care to be adopted entered the system between the ages of 0 to 3. Those are the critical years. 40% of kids in foster care have been there over 2 years. We're all familiar with the ACEs. There's a sheet about that in your folder. That's the Adverse Childhood Experiences study that revealed that 84% of children in the Oregon foster care system will struggle with lifelong issues such as hyperactivity, depression, OCD, as teens, addictive and criminal behavior. They're 1,200 times more likely to attempt suicide, and adults more likely to struggle with cancer, diabetes, heart disease. We need an innovative solution to keep these kids out of foster care to begin with. Our agency has a very successful and viable alternate path. Through our partnership with DHS, we can keep kids out of the system, give them early permanency at no cost to the taxpayers. I think that Oregon has a real opportunity here to be national leaders in child welfare innovation. So in 2010, I helped to clarify a policy at DHS that now allows high-risk moms the option of proactively planning an open adoption for their child before the baby is taken at the hospital, before her parental rights are terminated. So three scenarios. The first is a first-time mom, no prior DHS involvement, but she is struggling with addiction, incarceration, homelessness, mental illness, or domestic violence. So now if she'd like to plan an open adoption with our agency before the baby is born, or even after, DHS can allow that. The second scenario, which is what we see the most often, is mom does have a prior history with DHS. She's had children removed in the past. Perhaps she's experienced a DHS adoption. Now she's pregnant again. This time she wants an open adoption. And the third scenario, mom takes the baby home. The home health visiting nurse becomes very concerned about her ability to care for the child. If the child is under the age of 4 and she'd like to plan an open adoption, DHS will allow that. So I'd like to briefly talk about our process because it's very unique. We have an empowerment model for birth parents. We do extensive options counseling. We do whatever we can to reach out and include the birth father. We also honor family preservation. 90% of the moms we work with do not plan adoptions. If she does want to proceed with an adoption, she would look through a booklet of families that have been very carefully screened and trained and homesteaded by our agency. She would choose the families that she wants to learn more about. We would give her their family books, so you each have one of these to look through. This gives her a window into who these people are. How do they spend their time? What are their hobbies? What are their family traditions? What are their hopes and dreams for this child? How do they see this open adoption unfolding? We also give her their home study. She chooses the family she wants to meet. We're there to help them get to know each other, and they create an ongoing lifelong friendship that looks a lot like an extended family relationship. Together, they create a legally enforceable agreement for ongoing visits. The average number of visits is 3 to 4 per year. It's at that point that our 32-year history of relationship-building expertise kicks in, and we work behind the scenes with everyone to give them the skills and the tools they need to create a very strong and healthy foundation to their open adoption relationship. And then we're there for the life of their relationship, providing free counseling to the mom and free ongoing relationship guidance to all of the parties. We have a huge open adoption community with lots of ongoing events, one of the most popular of which is our annual retreat for birth moms. So she has a voice in her child's future. She has an active and honored role in her child's life. She's there to watch them grow. So let's talk about money. I feel that what we're offering is akin to preventative medicine as opposed to crisis intervention. I feel that working more closely with DHS, we can save the state some money, we can free up foster families, we can lighten DHS caseloads. The national cost of foster care, I'm told, is $40,000 per child per year. That plus the cost of the termination hearings, plus the preventative and then treatment services for these traumatized kids, is over $124 billion per year nationally. This is something we've been doing successfully for 32 years, and it's been a win-win for everyone. So our initiative is currently DHS will allow in most districts, most offices, a mom to proactively plan an open adoption, but this path is being underutilized. Moms can't really access it if they don't know that it exists. So we're advocating for an honest, transparent conversation at the hospital with the mom before her child is removed about her three options, which are parenting reunification, a DHS adoption, or an open adoption. And at that point, she can truly make an informed and empowered choice for her child's future. She can take ownership of that decision and not feel so victimized by the process. And I think by treating her with this dignity and respect, we can create a paradigm shift in how these women are seen so that we can destigmatize them and they're not defined by their limitations. So sure, maybe she can't be a full-time parent at this time in her life, but she can absolutely succeed in the more limited capacity of a birth mom, and that means everything to her and to her child. We have a long, successful history of doing free trainings throughout the state with DHS, CPS, self-sufficiency workers. We're happy to provide this training. We're also happy to go to the hospital and provide this information to the mom. Even if she's choosing a parenting reunification path, it's so important that she knows about all of her options in case a DHS adoption becomes imminent, and then she can use this as a backup plan. I did some research in other states. In Vermont, as we speak, State Senator Peg Flory is writing a new bill that will allow agencies to go to the hospital before the baby is removed to provide this transparent conversation. So I'd like to talk very briefly about how our process is different than the DHS adoption process. I think we have to remember that the DHS process is not the mom's choice. From her perspective, her child has been involuntarily removed. And in fact, for a DHS adoption to occur, the mom has to fail. In our process, the mom doesn't have to fail, and it's a very strengths-based approach. By the time the child is adopted in the DHS system, as Marilyn pointed out, they've spent an average of 3 years in the system. So they're impacted heavily by those mounting ACEs that we talked about. For the mom, after months, even years, of not meeting reunification goals, her relationship with DHS becomes adversarial, and she feels like a failure. If a DHS adoption is imminent, I could see that perhaps a voluntary relinquishment, a legally enforceable contract for ongoing contact, not visits, might be offered to her as a way to avoid the humiliation of a TPR hearing. But she's still not choosing a family based on her aspirations for her child, and she's still not receiving a fully open adoption with ongoing training and guidance. This is something we've done exclusively for 32 years. We know how to make open adoptions work, and birth moms continually tell us that they feel heard and valued and respected. So I'd like to show a really short video. This is a woman named Shireen being interviewed. She was in 40 different foster homes herself as a child. Just a sec before you start. As a young adult, she had two daughters. They were removed from her care and placed into foster care. She had a really strained and difficult relationship with the foster mom who hadn't let her visit her children in quite some time. She contacted us because she was pregnant again, and this time she wanted an open adoption. She chose Peter and Brady from our pool. They hit it off immediately, created a great relationship. She placed her newborn son with them. A year later, she got a call from DHS saying that her daughters had been removed from foster care due to neglect. And so she gathered her courage and called Peter and Brady to see if they would consider adopting her girls, too. So this is her story.
I chose to plan an adoption with Open Adoption and Family Services because I wanted my child to have a better upbringing. I wanted him to be happy. I wanted him to have a good life. I wanted him to have an open, free life, you know, where he could grow as a kid and really have no worries. He can be a normal child, and I can still try and be his mom the best I can. Picking the agency was one of the best things I've ever done. My experience was my girls felt unwanted, unloved. They would beg to come home constantly. They weren't happy. It was really hard and really tough to watch my children go through that and not be there every day to hold them. Tell them it's okay. So, making that decision when it came to what happened to my girls for my son was the best decision. I can't say it was quite the easiest, but I knew I was doing the right thing. After watching them go through what they went through and being shuffled into another foster home and asking, does anybody love me? You know, am I wanted? Yes, you're wanted. I want you every day. I want you every day. Trust me that. And I tell them that all the time. It's hard. Brady and Peter came to adopt my own daughters because things in the home they were supposed to permanently live in went awry when the family started to break up and the couple ended up getting a divorce and the children and the girls were removed. Because I had worked so hard to have Brady and Peter to have a bond with my girls because of their brother, every time Brady and Peter came to visit me, they would go visit the girls. So the girls could see their brother and spend time with him and bond with him. And they grew a great bond with them. And when I got the call that the girls had been removed, I immediately called Brady and Peter and told them what was going on. And Brady said, let me call Peter and I will call you back. And that's what they did. And so they stood up and they took my girls and have been wonderful fathers to them. Wonderful. The best daddies ever. Great, great role models. I couldn't ask for better fathers. I really couldn't. It means I get to be a part of my kids' life. I get to see them grow. I get to see them experience things. I may not get to be there every day, but I still get to enjoy and be involved. I get pictures, videos, text messages, phone calls. I see my kids every 3 months. I'm with them for a whole day, and we go out and we have lots of fun and make lots of memories and have such a wonderful time. And the bond is always strong. They're always happy to see their mom and always so excited. I think most of all is the hard work, the dedication, the consideration that they have for me as well, and the fact that even after adopting my son, they took on my two oldest. That never happens. And they have been their rock, and they continue to be their rock. And I don't think I could ever be more grateful for two men in my life who have stepped up to the plate. And they've really shown what it means to be the world's greatest fathers. And they truly are. They are the world's greatest fathers. And they're the reasons my kids are growing up happy, healthy, and normal children. but I couldn't ask for anything more.
Thank you for the opportunity to show that. So just to wrap up, we feel that DHS is tasked with an enormous job, and we want to help. We want to do what we do really well so they have more time to do what they do really well.
Thank you so much. Are there questions, Senator Montes Anderson?
Yes. How much does it cost to go through the
Our open agency adoption? Process is about $27,000. We're among the lowest priced in the state, in the Northwest. There currently is a $13,000 federal tax credit for adoptive parents that thankfully has been voted in to remain that helps to offset that price. And we also are unique in that we're providing lifelong services, so free counseling for the mom and free relationship guidance for all parties.
So, I mean, I've had a couple of friends who have gone through the open adoption of process, and they certainly can't afford that. I think that for some, like the person that you had here, it worked out really, really well. Mm-hmm. But having worked with so many families whose kids have had to be removed, not all of them would fit that.
Right. Well, Shireen actually has had a very, very difficult life. As I mentioned, she was in 40 different foster homes herself as a child, and DHS will not allow her to parent her children. So all of the visits that they have are not at Peter and Brady's home. She doesn't have their address. But I think when you start the process by treating the mom with respect and giving her a decision-making role and a lot of information and choices, that she rises to that. And maybe she can't be this full-time mom, but she absolutely holds it together for the 2, 3, 4 visits that she has per year. That means everything to her. And she could come away from that with a sense of pride. When you give a mom a situation where they sort of just fade away in shame, that child is left with a burden of always fearing they're going to become their parent, their birth parent, and whatever difficulties they're struggling with, they feel like that's just hanging over them and that's in their future. Whereas if you have a situation where you can welcome them in whatever capacity they can manage, then the child knows who they are and knows that they're cared about and loved, and they don't fear that they're going to become something, you know, some horrible story that they've heard about their birth parents.
So, and this would be a question for all three of you. are there any states that are looking at just open adoption in general as it relates to child welfare practice? In the private adoption world, it seems like it's now much more rare to have a closed adoption without ongoing contact, and you have the legally enforceable open adoption agreements. Mm-hmm. Is that something that sometimes have safety plans that are part of them if the person can't have the address or whatever? Is that something that any state is looking at to kind of move beyond an all or nothing approach to child protective services? Either you're reunified or you don't have contact. Is there a way to build these extended families that allow these connections to be maintained over time?
Chair Gelser and the committee, we do have adoptions that are open adoptions. They're mediated, mm-hmm. and there is a binding agreement between families and birth families. That is not in every case, but in a lot of cases, foster families or adoptive families decide that that's the route that they want to go.
Oh, I'm sorry, were you going to say something? I didn't mean to interrupt. I do want to point out, though, that there's a spectrum of openness, and it all has to do with the way the birth mom is treated at the very beginning of the process. So giving her choices, like the ability to choose a family and the ability to have ongoing visits, it's that a qualitative difference in the how satisfying that experience is for her. So, I mean, we would love to come into DHS and do more trainings in how to have open adoptions. Technology is a great gift for open adoption. There's so many ways that you can keep someone current in your life, even if they're not able to directly visit. You can post things to a virtual cloud, pictures that the child has drawn, pictures of them. You can have Facebook messages. There's so many varied ways of staying in touch. But it all starts with really valuing the birth parent, that they have intrinsic value.
Thank you. And then one other question that's for DHS. In the so for a general adoptee, there's the my mind is blanking. The birth parent and child registry are. Birth parents, when they go through the CPS process and their parental rights are terminated, are they also given that registry information so that they can put themselves on that registry to be contacted by their children when the children decide to do so?
Chair Gelser and the committee, I can't confirm that. I can certainly look into it and get back to you.
Okay.
I believe that they are given the information so that they know that there is a registry, but I cannot confirm to you that it happens across the state.
And that would be a worthwhile thing. And the second question, the law changed a couple of years ago to allow children under the age of 18 with the permission of their parents to begin that search before their 18th birthday. I would be interested in knowing if youth adopted youth that are adopted through the system are aware of that option, and if their adoptive parents are aware of that option, if they're trying to reunify or reconnect or get more information about who they are and where they came from. I know that is a life-changing experience for adoptees to be able to connect in that way. Right, anything further for this panel? All right, thank you all very much.
So much.
And Marilyn, it looks like you made it. Well done.
Collect these books, but you can keep the folders.
So let's pass the these down. Shutterfly makes these very nice. I remember the binder and lots of days at Kinko's. All right, we're going to close the informational hearing on general applicant adoption and open up an informational hearing on recruitment for the superintendent of the state hospital update. So, Pat Allen, welcome.
Thank you.
And thank you, DHS, and to all the people that worked on the data to build the presentations today.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. Patrick Allen, Director of the Oregon Health Authority, here with a very, very brief update on the recruitment for the administrator of the state hospital. This is a recruitment that we were very close to having a selected candidate just as there was a change in leadership at the agency, and I suspect that change in leadership contributed to the viable. I think there were two strong candidates who withdrew at that time, and so we are getting ready to restart that that recruitment. Presumably, as of sometime today, I'll be confirmed as the permanent director of the health authority, and we actually think that'll probably help in terms of recruitment. We're also working with DAS to do a couple of, I guess, what are really all fundamentally stylistic things, but we think they're important to help improve the pool of candidates. The first is compensation. The stated compensation for the position is really quite low from for what's competitive for hospital administrators, and we historically deal with that with using a tool in government we call a payline exception, so we go above the stated pay and pay a competitive salary. Historically, we tend to offer the job at the stated pay and then negotiate the pay line exception, but that really kind of pitches to insiders who need to know that's the way the system works, and we're going to try to turn that around and actually recruit the job with where we would end up at the, as the result of a pay line exception. That probably leaves a little bit on the table in terms of negotiating, but plus or minus a few thousand dollars on the salary is not really the fundamental problem here. It's getting the right person to do a very important job. Second thing, I use the phrase administrator. Actually, it's titled in the state system as the superintendent of the state hospital. That comes from institutional management language, and we have two kinds of residential institutions in the state hospital and prisons. And so we're interested actually in kind of changing the terminology around that to be much more consistent with administrator, which is typically the a title used in running a medical facility, which the state hospital fundamentally is. The last point I want to make is just to acknowledge how critical this position is. It's a key part of the management team of the agency. It's critical to the successful execution of the Oregon Performance Plan with the U.S. Department of Justice. And while we have a number of really key positions to fill, I would say this one's at the top of my list, and we expect to roll that recruitment out shortly. And I hope to have identified a selected candidate by the first of the year. Be happy to answer questions that you might have.
Any questions?
Great. Thank
Excellent.
You.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much. And well, I guess welcome. Yeah. We can welcome you tomorrow.
Right.
Officially.
Right.
All right.
A couple of hours.
So we'll close the informational hearing on the state hospital recruitment and open an informational hearing on state hospital civil commitment data.
Good morning, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. I'm Mike Morris, and I'm the Behavioral Health Policy Administrator with the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here this morning to provide you some overview of civil commitment and the latest data regarding civil commitment. So first, I want to give you, just to orient you to what civil commitment is, and first of all, to do that, I think it's important to understand why we have a civil commitment process, and it really goes back to our U.S. Constitution, and so it is a civil rights issue. Anytime there is a deprivation of a civil right, especially liberty, you need to have due process to take that or limit that particular right away. So. And the civil commitment process is that due process of taking somebody's liberty away. It is one of the few things in our country and in our state that you can take somebody and detain them because of something they might do, not as something that they did do or alleged to have done. So this is a kind of a preemptive taking someone's liberty away. So that's why it's really important to have the right due process. It helps to provide the context to then talk about the more, you know, complex issue of individuals who have a mental illness. And it gets to the point that they become a danger to themselves or others and are in need of treatment and aren't accepting of treatment or refusing. And so their situation deteriorates, and then you need to have a system to provide that intervention against their will at that point in time. So you have to balance that need for treatment and protecting of the community as well as that individual balance with the civil rights that they are entitled to also. So this is a really, really high level overview. There are nuances along the way, but I thought it would be best to give you this kind of really general overview. And then if you have questions, I can ask about some of the nuances. So first of all, is the criteria for civil commitment. It is a danger to self or a danger to others or inability to care for themselves and such that they are at risk of death or serious injury because of their inability to care. And that has to be tied to the fact that they have a mental illness. It is the mental illness that's causing the danger to themselves or others or inability to care. So there is a process for the civil commitment. The first process is someone entering that arena. And Generally speaking, they arrive at a hospital, and they can arrive at a hospital in a number of ways. They can arrive by a family member, take him to the hospital. They can arrive through police or an ambulance on some kind of what we call a custody. So they're picked up off the street and then taken to a hospital. Once they are at the hospital, then there's another decision point of a physician and another physician or even a qualified mental health professional makes a determination of whether or not they meet the criteria to be held, and then they can place a hold on the individual. So once a hold is placed, there is an investigation that takes place. That hold is for 5 judicial days, so that's basically 5 business days or any days that the court is open. So that can mean that individual can be detained prior to a hearing for as much as maybe 9 or 10 days if it happens on a holiday weekend or something like that. So the investigation takes place. Community Mental Health Program has investigators. Our agency does the training and certification of those investigators. They go out, they interview the individual, they interview the hospital staff, they interview other individuals who might have knowledge, which could be family members or even people in the neighborhood, et cetera. So they do the investigation, they write a report, and then the decision at that point is to recommend a hearing or no hearing. And so that is a decision point.
Ms. Morris, if they decide there's no hearing, then the individual is released at that point?
So yes, they are no longer under the hold, so they can be released. Or they could, at that point, sign in voluntarily, which is sometimes the case. There are some cases an individual is intoxicated, comes in on a Friday night, and due to that intoxication, is depressed and, expressing suicide ideation. And so they're placed on a hold, before Monday even comes around. A doctor interviews them and says this person has sobered up. There are supports in the family and no longer needs to be detained in the hospital. And so the physician can release the person at that point, even before before an investigation really gets going. So once there's a determination, recommendation for a hearing, there is a hearing. And so that is with a judge, and there is what's called a mental health examiner that is present who does a further examination of the individual and recommends to the court as far as a determination. And the judge weighs that as well as the, what takes place as far as witnesses in interviews in the court hearing. Those hearings can take place in a standard courtroom, and in some cases they take place in a hospital setting. A hospital may make arrangements for a room to be used for the hearing. So at the hearing, at the end of it, the judge needs to make a determination whether the person is indeed meets the criteria and needs to be detained, or that there needs to be a civil commitment issued. So it can be either a commitment or the person ends up being released. In regards to that, what does it mean, civil commitment? The civil commitment is up to 180 days, but it can be recertified. After 180 days, you go back to court and demonstrate to the court that the condition remains and the person needs to continue civil commitment. The options around civil commitment, people tend to think about civil commitment is inpatient. The person is confined in a hospital, or they can receive outpatient commitment. It's more rarely used, and I'll explain that in a minute. More rarely used in Oregon. There's just a handful a year of that. And then there is what's called a trial visit. So someone can initially be detained in a hospital under civil commitment, and then through the process of no longer needs inpatient care, but there is still a need for the civil commitment to remain intact. There is a plan written up, and there is an agreement by the community mental health program to take that person and continue them on the civil commitment under a trial visit. That is typically what happens, and that is when people have asked me regarding outpatient commitment, can we use outpatient commitment? We essentially have that in the form of a trial visit. So it's not uncommon for someone to be civilly committed, return to the hospital, and then within a few days after completing treatment there, then they are back out in the community. So that's typically the way Oregon has taken the path of supporting people in the community under civil commitment. There is a new term and new option available. It's called assisted outpatient treatment. This happened in 2013 legislative session. A bill was passed that permitted assisted outpatient treatment. It has a lower threshold than civil commitment. You don't have to demonstrate the dangerousness necessarily, but you can demonstrate that the person is in need of treatment, and if they don't receive the treatment, things will deteriorate and they could potentially become dangerous. And so a judge can place someone on assisted outpatient treatment and then order them to continue services in the community. It is still relatively new, and it is, we don't have really good data regarding if it's being used anecdotally. We're being told by communities and judges that it's hard to implement assisted outpatient treatment because if someone does not comply with the assisted outpatient treatment, there are a few options available to the court as far as what to do with that. At this point, the only option judges have is to find a person in contempt of court, and then that puts a person in jail, and the judges don't want to do that. So this is something that is still growing and maturing to see if this is an option that we can build some supports around this. So in regards to, we have data regarding investigations. So this is basically reflective of individuals who are placed on hold starting that civil commitment process. This goes back 21 years, back to 1996. And if you look at the trend line over that period of time, we have increased in the number of investigations. You will notice in 2014 there was a big drop. We instituted a new data system, and so that is reflected there, and we are working internally on the investigation data getting into the system to kind of clean this up to get a better understanding of really is the trend continuing to go up or is it actually going down for investigations. At the same time, you have the civil commitments in total actually over the 20 years has declined. If you go back 9 years, it looks like it's fairly, it goes up and down, but it's fairly even with a slight increase if you look at that. We did, especially in 2015, did some major cleanup working with our community mental health partners to clean up the civil commitment data. One of the reasons is we need to have good data there because we have to report this data into the FBI for background checks. And so, the data seems much more reliable than the investigation data since 2014. But it has kind of leveled off, maybe a slight increase since then. This is a challenging issue. It's a civil rights versus need for treatment. And there's I've been involved in situations where families are really struggling with their family member to get them into treatment. A person refuses, and they try the civil commitment route, and they're frustrated with that process and the judge releasing them because they didn't meet the criteria. So it is a challenging to balance those issues. I've been involved in various work groups over the years, and one thing that I've consistently found is that all the advocates on both sides of the issue agree that we need more robust services in the community with improved access and that assertive outreach to reach out to individuals who aren't normally kind of crossing the threshold of a community mental health program to get those services out to individuals. So that is the one area that I think there's common agreement and a focus. Sometimes people ask me in regards to U.S. Department of Justice has been investigating our community mental health system for adults with serious and persistent mental illness. So people have asked me, how does, changing the civil commitment law affect, that investigation? The investigation is based on what's called the Olmstead decision. It's a Supreme Court decision based on the ADA that says that individuals should not be segregated because of a disability and kept in large institutions. And so they need to be in more integrated settings in the community. They came in and, have been investigating us around that issue in the community mental health system. We have what is we refer to as a cooperative agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice called our Oregon Performance Plan, and it is a focus on building up our community system to be able to support individuals to live successfully in the community. And it deals with both ends of the spectrum as far as what can we do on the front end to intervene and provide services to individuals so they don't end up being in jail or hospitals. And so we've expanded thanks to a significant investment by the legislature since 2013, investment in mobile crisis services to serve community treatment to provide those robust community services. And then the other aspect is to the focus on moving people that end up in the state hospital out into the community. And so that is the focus of our work. People sometimes will say that, a USDLJ won't like increased civil commitments. I haven't heard that from them. That hasn't been a focus for them. But I do know that civil commitment, depends on how it's implemented, could lead to people being in higher levels of care. And that was a concern around assisted outpatient treatment to try and tighten that up, that if someone didn't comply, that they could go back to court and then end up being referred or sent to the state hospital. We didn't want that. And so there's not a
Mr. Morris, I have to ask you to kind of summarize a little bit. We've fallen a little bit behind, unfortunately.
So we are working on a behavioral health collaborative with the Oregon Performance Plan to really focus the community on the CCOs and the community mental health programs to increase the access to services and so that there is improved transparency, leveraging of funding, and just overall improved access to care.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm going to ask us to direct questions to him offline just so that we can get through the last presentation and get to the floor on time. But you have a really important question, and so Senator Dembrough is going to ask you a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just have one question. That is, what is the legal representation that the individual has throughout this process?
They are, Chair Gelser and Senator Dembrough, they are assigned a public defender usually, or they could get their own attorney, but they do get a public defender to represent them.
And does that individual tend to work with them throughout the process? Is there a continuous kind of support there?
To be honest with you, that is variable. I've seen sometimes situations where the public defender shows up at the hearing. That's the first time they are introduced and meet the individual. So,
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and okay, thanks for taking the time to compile all this data. I know that was a lot of work. All right, we're going to close the information hearing on the Oregon State Hospital and open an information hearing on the Early Learning Division and an update on a 2018 legislative proposal. And we have legislators here. Do you guys want to come first? What I know you've all kind of planned your plan.
I'd like to hear them first because I have to go to caucus. So.
Okay, very good.
That would be helpful for me.
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe you want to hear the legislators
yes,
first?
Yes, I'll
hear them
anytime.
Okay, great. They're House members.
I don't want them to think I'm walking out because of you. We wouldn't think that. Senator.
Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Gelser and Senators. My name is, for the record, my name is Miriam Galeron. I'm the Early Learning System Director. We have quite a presentation here where we'll be shuffling with folks, but I will hand it over first to our representatives who have been important partners in an effort to strengthen monitoring around child safety issues in licensed child care facilities. Don Woods, our child care director, will also present on some of the issues that we've been working on as part of a statutory work group led by Chair Lively and Representative Peluso. And then Dr. Richardson with DHS will join me and we'll talk a little bit and update you about collaboration around the way CPS and DHS and the Office of Child Care Early Learning Division work together on investigations of child safety concerns in licensed child care. So with that, I will turn it over to Chair Lively.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is John Lively. I'm state representative from Springfield, and I'm the chair of the Early Childhood Family Supports Committee in the House, and had the pleasure of chairing this particular work group also. This work actually started before the session ended. Our last session ended as we started talking about these issues and what it might take to start addressing them, and at that point agreed to have this work group to start talking about it and doing it. So a couple things I would just want to emphasize. One, it's critically important work because it's about the safety of our children. And so there's a lot of different things that intercede that impact this work, but this particular work is very critical. And it does not mean that by doing this work now that we weren't doing a good job before. It only means we learn more and conditions change over time. And as those conditions change, we need to respond to those. So from that standpoint, I just want to emphasize that we go through. Secondly, from the standpoint of the work group, we had multiple meetings and we had a large stakeholder group. And I've served on several different work groups, and some of them go well and some don't go quite so well. But it was a great process. And from my personal stance, where I started and where we started, I think, as a work group and where we ended up was very different because we learned a lot as we went along, which helped us to address some issues that we didn't necessarily think when we started to address. So for me, that's the positive thing. And just third, I would just emphasize, so our intent is on our committee is to introduce, we're working on a committee bill to introduce to address these things. And as it being a short session, we have limited time in which to make changes to that. But you'll hear today the outline of what that is and be able to ask questions about that. But I look forward to working with you this session and beyond as we work on these issues. Representative Peluso is also the vice chair of my House committee, but was also at all these work group meetings and helping to work through this process. So,
thank you, Chair Lively. Good morning. My name is Carla Peluso. I proudly represent House District 50, the city of Gresham, and an honor to be here. And I'm fascinated by the low ambience of the lighting. Is that what?
Welcome to the dark side.
So really, my job was to be the closer today, and so I just wanted to talk about the collaboration of this of the work group to bring forth really the challenging issues facing our child care system and the needs for our children. And so we brought a wide variety of people, Ask Me, Children's First, plenty of folks from the Early Learning Division, and the conversations at times could get heated, and that was really, really important so that we do get to the right answers and are open and upfront and transparent with really what the challenges are and what we need to do. So we are not done with our work. We have no expectation of that, of even putting an ending point to it. At this stage of the game, it will be completed when we're doing what we need to do to keep our kids healthy and safe and secure and thriving. So thank you so much for allowing us to be here.
Thank you. Any questions for the members before they go, especially you, Senator? Nope.
And thank you for making us so welcome. I do appreciate that.
Well, next time we'll get you better lighting.
Oh, okay.
I look younger here.
This is good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we'll ask Don Woods, our Director of Child Care, to talk through some of the issues at the work group. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Dawn Woods, and I'm the Child Care Director for the Early Learning Division. Chair Gelser, members of the Senate, I wanted to share with you, kind of provide an overview, and then I'll go a little deeper into what these really mean in a practical sense. And so the summary of the proposed changes for this short session that are looking to be introduced is one that allows the Office of Child Care to take action when a license expires, protect children from providers who have had previous and significant licensing violations, to grant the Office of Child Care the ability to issue cease and desist orders, and also levy higher civil penalties, particularly around illegal care, and also increase civil penalties that are allowed to cap it within statute. We're also looking to impose more explicit conditions on licenses, make that very clear that we have that authority, as well as to foster better information sharing and collaboration for the Office of Child Care and Department of Human Services. And that's what Director and Dr. Richardson will be sharing with you as well. So the issue around continuing jurisdiction is currently our statutes. Once a license expires for a child care facility, and say we're in the middle of an enforcement action, we cannot finish that legal action. And so by having continuing jurisdiction, we're able to continue that legal action to make sure that whatever action we were taking is concluded. If there was any hearing needing, that would all be addressed so that if, say, they were to reapply, we would really have that record and be able to save staff time and expense and make sure we don't miss anything by having a finished legal action. The second area is in terms of exempt provider prohibition. And this is currently, there's some loopholes within our current statute. And what this exempt prohibition really means is that if an action is taken on a child care provider, that they would not be allowed to provide care for 5 years. So it really is a tool to be used so that people who have demonstrated some risk to children are not able to provide even licensed exempt care. They're only able to care for their own children. And so by closing this loophole, we're actually able to, sometimes we have situations where we close a facility that an individual is working in, they just bring in another provider and they're still in the home and caring for children. So this would allow us to kind of shore up that loophole. The next area is in terms of a cease and desist orders. And this really needs to pair closely with civil penalties. But currently, when illegal care is happening, which is caring for more than three children, we have very small civil penalties, which I'll share with you. But we also are really only action in terms of moving to a criminal nature is in terms of injunction, which is very time intensive. It takes a long time, 3 to 4 months to conclude. And you also have to show a real pattern of providing illegal care. So a cease and desist order provides a little more weight in terms of we're serious. This, you know, you need to stop providing illegal care. It's unfortunate. We sometimes have, you know, individuals caring for 29 children at a time, one person. And that is certainly not a safe environment for those children to be in with only one adult. The next area is in civil penalties. Our current penalty structure is really low. Currently, the maximum civil penalty you can get is $100, which is not acting as a deterrent for violations that a program may have or an individual. And so we're looking at increasing the civil penalty amounts and establishing a cap in statute, somewhere between $750 and $2,500, depending on the size of the program as well as the risk of the violation. And so that would allow feeds in as well to our kind of progressive discipline or progressive enforcement of our actions to really have these serve as a deterrent for not following the rules or providing illegal care. The next area is looking as we have, it's not clear about our ability to provide conditions on a license. And so it's implied in our statute, but we're wanting to make it explicitly clear so that we can, there might be times, let's say in a family child care home where the way the yard is situated, that there's kind of an L, so there's an area where there's not supervision. And so we may say you have to be outside on the playground, you can't observe from the porch or the kitchen window, the sliding glass door, you're gonna need to be present. We often will have conditions around trampoline use. So there's some areas, particularly within family homes, that we need that real explicit right to make sure that that conditions are placed on a license to reinforce and to ensure the kids' safety. Another area that we're looking at adding into our statute is to look at tiered progressive enforcement structure. And what that really is looking at, that our rules are, the kind of the foundational health and safety standards, and we're wanting to provide kind of a tiered enforcement. That would provide both transparency to providers and to parents in terms of the compliance history of that program, and really give clear, consistent guidelines for when we take certain enforcement actions. You can kind of think about it like a driver's license in terms of point that you get on your license, at a certain level of points is when a certain action would be looked at providing. And the next one is...
Thank you, John. So as Chair Lively and Representative Peluso spoke to, we are looking at the issues that Don just talked about as part of legislation for 2018. For the Early Learning Division, we'll be providing support and technical assistance to the House Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee as they work on that legislation. Hello, Dr. Richardson. Thank you. The last issue I wanted to talk about is the collaboration with the Department of Human Services. Both the Early Learning Division and DHS have shared responsibility, yet very distinct and complementary roles. As we look at responding to concerns about child safety in licensed child care facilities. We have, as part of our work, to look very comprehensively at our licensing program and enhancements that we could make to respond to and strengthen child protection and child safety, have been working with Dr. Richardson and DHS to identify areas where we can enhance our work together. So one of the things I wanted to mention is that we are working on a memorandum to send to you, Chair Gelser, and also Chair Lively, that will detail some of the things more specifically that we're talking about, and we are working to finalize that. But our understanding, and as we've identified and talked through a number of these issues, is that we can do a number of these things through an intergovernmental agreement, and are committed to, if we hit any challenges along the way with that, where we feel like we need resources or statutory changes, to being able to come back to both you and the House Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee and talk about what those challenges are. But to keep it very brief, I will say that the areas that have come up so far are really and kind of around among sort of three buckets. One is the ability to really conduct joint investigations together. So when there is allegation of abuse or neglect at a licensed child care facility, we conduct, again, separate but coordinated investigations. And ultimately, the role of the Office of Child Care Staff is to really be deferential to the initial investigation of law enforcement, our partnering agencies, including CPS. And that is definitely to ensure that we don't hinder the investigation. At the same time, to be able to build stronger cases around actions that we are taking in legal legal proceedings, it would be helpful for OCC to be able to have firsthand information in some of these investigations. And so one of the areas that we are exploring is could we really conduct joint investigations, which would require OCC to have highly trained and specialized staff to be able to accompany CPS. But that is one of the areas that we're exploring and we're really excited about. The second area is around information sharing. So there are a number, there is already really good and strong collaboration and information that we get from CPS and their reports around the investigations. And obviously that information is essential for us really to be able to take action. Anytime there is a investigation and a finding that CPS makes, our regulations on the childcare side have, you know, there's been a violation of one of our regulations. And so that information is critical. So while there is a lot of information sharing, we're really looking to explore what more could we do to be more efficient in giving immediate access to staff in both agencies, as well as really ensuring that it's very clear to staff, right, that the current scope of OCC's access to information that CPS has. And the last area that I'll mention is related to findings. So as CPS and DHS conduct their investigations in some rare instances, but it does happen, they are unable to determine who the perpetrator was of a harm or abuse to a child, but they can conclude where the abuse or harm occurred. And in those instances, we are going to be working with DHS so that the conclusions of their investigations make clear where harm occurred, and that will, we believe, open up an area for OCC to be able to look at accountability and responsibility of the facility around supervision and care of children. So, again, concluding here, and the idea is that DHS would, reach a conclusion in their investigation that clearly identified where abuse occurred in a facility. Even if they can't identify who the perpetrator is, and then that would allow OCC to look at other actions against that facility. So, Dr. Richardson, anything you want to add?
For the record, Reginald Richardson, Deputy Director, DHS. Director Calderon has already sort of described the framework of shared responsibility that both DHS through our Child Protective Services area and her Office of Child Care, what we're working toward. We're in the process, again, of sort of finalizing the memorandum of understanding or our interagency agreement, as well as looking at what statutes or rules may need to be changed in order to continue our collaboration and make it easier. One of the areas that we're still pursuing that I don't quite understand is the notion of sharing of background check information. And so there may be some legislative fix that we need to be asking for in order to make sure that that information is seamless. But the sort of message that I want to share is that we are committed at DHS to work with the Early Learning Division to help make licensed child care facilities safer for our kids. It's an important area for us, and we're committed to making sure that we close the gaps where they are.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Great work. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, so we will close our informational hearing on the Early Learning Division. We've got the overview of committed bills for 2018. Nothing's changed since last month. We've got the disabled parents and child welfare, a fix for adoption agencies, and the licensing issue for the, which we may not actually need for the communication between OHA and DHS. And then just as an FYI, I know my personal bill that's coming here, we talked about last time, it's that fix for OWAPI that clarifies they can investigate at the state hospital and that people are protected when they're severely and persistently mentally ill, whether it's the CCO or the county mental health program that pays for it. That bill is also going to house the clarification that has been requested in the wake of the Salem-Kaiser School District believing that they need to report all consensual sexual contact between kids. We believe that is unusual and unprecedented interpretation of the law, and we certainly do not want to overwhelm our child welfare hotline after every middle school dance. So we have met with the Salem Kaiser School District, provided language to them that we will be using. We've worked with the Marion County District Attorney and are hopeful that that the Salem Kaiser School District will not move forward with this new interpretation of the law, because it would be unfortunate to have pregnancies, untreated STDs, or the inability to talk about what consent actually is in between now and the February session. So that's coming our way and seems to be a very popular initiative. We've heard from every organization, I believe, that represents mandatory reporters, especially doctors and nurses, who the way that would impact them would be pretty significant. Anything else? Do either of you have bills that are coming to this committee?
No.
All right. Well, I guess that's it. Thank you all very much, and we're adjourned. I guess that's it. Thank you all very much, and we're adjourned.